From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. A new poll from USC Dornsife and the LA Times shows a shift in views among Republicans across the country. President Trump appears to be solidifying support within the party, but at some significant cost and erosion as well. We'll talk about the shift seen in the poll right after the news. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Hope your day's going well. Maybe you're even one of the lucky ones with tickets to see the Rolling Stones tonight at the Rose Bowl. Big concert. Who knows if it's their last time in Southern California on tour? Though the way those guys keep going, I wouldn't count them out ever. But we're going to, a little bit later this hour, open up the lines to hear from those of you that have seen the Stones in particularly great performances, maybe historic performances. We'll hear what you have to say about it. We'll listen to some music. That's coming up later this hour. But first, we begin with a brand new USC Dornsife LA Times national poll of Republican and Republican-leaning independent likely voters. It asked them about the future of their party and where they see themselves ideologically as Republicans. One of the fascinating results is to the question asking whether the Republicans see themselves as more traditional in the sense of being stressing fiscal responsibility, national defense, pro-business policies, or whether they're more aligned with the populist policies of President Trump, stressing strong borders, protecting jobs from foreign competition, and standing tough against crime and social disorder. With us to talk about the results of the poll, Bob Schrum, director of the USC Dornsife Center for the Political Future. Bob, good to have you with us again.
Glad to be here, Larry.
So detail the findings for us on this essential question as to how Republicans and Republican leaners see themselves.
Well, 44% of Republicans and Republican leaners think that the Republican Party should become even more populist, stronger on the issues you mentioned. 26% think it should revert to being more traditionally conservative, and 13% think it should stay largely the way it is today. Bottom line, this is Trump's party. The GOP is DJT's party. And I don't think you're going to see much change in that. One implication of this, by the way, I think, is that if someone were to challenge President Trump in the primaries, they might be able to get 20-25% of the vote, at least early on. One footnote to this, Republican leaners actually differ from the whole vote of Republicans and Republican leaners put together. If you just strip out the leaners, they actually favor a more traditional conservatism by about a 5% margin. Now, the president's paying a price for this and for the fact that he has kind of a monopoly on this party, because when we ask all voters in the same poll whether they would be completely or mostly happy or unhappy if he got reelected, the answer was 54% would be mostly or completely unhappy, and 29% would be mostly or completely happy. And even inside that, only 40% of the Republican leaners say they would be happy, and 70% of them voted for him in 2016. So he's got a fairly steep hill to climb in terms of how voters are feeling about him, even though he has consolidated his hold over the Republican Party.
I've thought that perhaps there is a reluctance of some Trump supporters to admit that to pollsters because of such strong negative feelings against the president. And do you have a sense that there might be additional Trump support that's hidden in this poll?
No, I don't, because as you may recall, this was the one poll in 2016, and it kept being attacked all the time, and Trump kept citing it, that said he had a chance to win. And that's because of the nature of the poll. There are 5,390 respondents. They're recruited by mail using zip codes. If they don't have an iPad, we get one for them. If they don't have internet service, we provide that for them. And they have proven over time completely willing to say that they're for Donald Trump if they are. So I don't think in this particular poll, which is not a traditional telephone poll, it's this very large national panel, which answers questions not just about politics, but about all sorts of issues all the time. There's a lot of trust between the respondents and the people who are administering the poll.
We're talking with Bob Schramm, who is the director of the USC Dornsife Center for the Political Future. And Dornsife, along with the LA Times, conducting this poll, which shows that most Republicans are happy with a more populist party. I was a little bit surprised because I thought that much of the support for President Trump was sort of around him, was seeing him as someone who could get Republican priorities actually accomplished, the tax cut, the Supreme Court justices, seeing him as someone who could carry that out. What this poll indicates is that philosophically, there is alignment, particularly looking at the Trump leaners, with the populist policies of President Trump. I'd like to hear from you if you're a registered Republican, if you are an independent who leans Republican. What do you think about what this poll shows? Would you say that among your Republican friends and family members that they are of the more populist mind or more the traditional conservative, pro-business, limited government, strong national defense, traditional Republican perspective? 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. Of course, traditionally, Republicans have been supporters of free trade. President Trump, with his tariffs, with his talks about China and about the EU and NAFTA, of course, all of this highly critical of the trade deals that were struck under President Obama and the free trading position. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also with me is Reed Galen, a political strategist who was deputy campaign manager for John McCain's 2008 presidential campaign and deputy campaign manager for the Schwarzenegger 2006 re-election campaign here in California. Reed, good to have you with us again.
Thanks for having me.
What do you think of this result in the populist versus traditional conservative ideology?
You know, I don't know that it really surprises me, as Bob knows with his long history in national politics. For Republicans, you know, the populist wing, you know, has always been there. If you go, you know, isolationist, nativist wing has always existed within the Republican Party. If you go back to the 1930s, pre-World War II, or even post-World War II with, Senator Bob Taft from Ohio. So the idea, you know, and obviously the virulent opposition to FDR, New Deal, LBJ, any of those things. So not at all surprising. I think what's interesting here, though, is that, you know, post-President George W. Bush, if you saw it, you know, with Sarah Palin, you know, sort of cracking the door open, the Tea Party sort of, you know, screaming through the door like Jack Nicholson in The Shining, and then Donald Trump just blowing the door off the hinges altogether. It's allowed a lot of people who probably felt otherwise left behind by this sort of establishment country club Republicans to finally find their voice. I think the problem is now at this point in American political history and American society, that voice is one that less and less people from a national or electoral perspective, I think, are wanting to listen to. And I think you don't have to go much further than just a few miles south, Larry, of where you're sitting right now, where we saw another LA Times story highlighting the fact that Orange County, California, long a bastion of Republicanism, Reagan country, has now gone from red to blue in terms of registration.
So, Reed, then what happened to the Tea Party movement? Because that is a more small L libertarian minded, smaller government, in some ways kind of a hardcore fiscally oriented version of the GOP. So what happened to them?
So I think what you saw in the Tea Party is I think like you see in a lot of political movements, which is they might rally. They called themselves the Tea Party. They might have rallied around, you know, that idea of fiscal conservative and smaller government. But it was really a rejection of President Obama, and I think specifically Obamacare. And so I think the thread that runs through from the Tea Party to today is no different. I think the idea, though, is that it is just a wholesale rejection of what they see as a culture that they don't like, they don't approve of, and frankly, probably doesn't approve of them in some respects. And so I think what you're seeing right now, too, is among the Republican Party. And we've seen this coming for years in California, where the party now is third behind Democrats and no party preference. It is a shrinking core of harder and harder core people that, you know, it is going to, you know, maybe not in 2020, maybe not in 2022. But we also already see hemorrhaging in suburban areas, even in not only in California for years, but now in places like Texas. And, you know, in these places that, you know, voters might have held their nose for Donald Trump because they had had so many longstanding years of opposition to Hillary Clinton. You know, they might be free of that now. So I think from the party's perspective, I think it could be a very difficult future if this is the path they're going to be on.
Reid Gehling joining us on Air Talk. He's an independent political strategist, but was deputy campaign manager both for John McCain and Arnold Schwarzenegger. Again, I'd like to hear from you if you are a registered Republican or independent, but lean Republican in your voting patterns. Your thoughts about this USC Dornsife LA Times poll, which shows that among Republicans, 47% are on the more populist, 25% more traditionally conservative. Among independents who lean Republican, oddly 36% are more traditionally conservative and 31% more populist. So you see the Republican Party clearly moving in this populist direction. I wonder, Bob Schrum, does this open up the door for any sort of place for another party or sort of traditional Republicanism, or are there just not enough people who hold that view anymore?
Well, I think that we'll have to wait and see after the 2020 election, depending on its outcome, whether or not something like that happens. I think far less likely than a new party is a Republican Party that ultimately remakes itself and returns to its roots. But that's going to be a very big struggle, partly because, as Reid suggests, the party is shrinking. It's about 30% of the electorate. It's the third party in California. And the suburbs are defecting. This creates enormous difficulties in terms of people inside the party trying to move it in a different direction. And you see this also in our data here, because independents who lean neither Republican or Democrat would be 15% completely or mostly happy if Trump won, 50% completely or mostly unhappy if he won. Those kinds of independents voted for Trump in 2016. So I'd say this is a real warning signal about 2020.
Now, the other side of that is we don't have a Democratic nominee yet. And so you're going to have a real person there battling President Trump. And, you know, as there was 3 years ago, you could end up with two highly unpopular candidates facing each other.
I think that it is likely that Trump obviously will stay unpopular unless something big changes, and the Democratic nominee, as the election polarizes, will become less popular, whoever that person is. The bottom line for me, looking at these numbers, is I don't see how Trump wins, but I think Democrats could manage to lose.
Reid Gehling, you see it that way?
I think absolutely. I think the issue that the Democrats face is that, you know, and again, you know, Larry, you brought it up, is that, you know, next fall, it is overwhelmingly likely that voters across the country will only have, you know, two choices that might otherwise be unelectable, right, against a more traditional politician. I don't even want to call it Republican or Democrat at this point. But if it's a Bernie Sanders or an Elizabeth Warren versus a Donald Trump, you know, the question many voters, you know, and let's call it those 80,000 voters in the Midwest that the LA Times article references, you know, are they willing to stand for four more years of Trump because they see him as, you know, is, you know, a buffoon, but not someone who is, you know, sort of completely antithetical to how they believe the world works, or are they willing to go for, you know, a much different vision of where politics in America has been lately, which is, you know, more government control and those sorts of things. I'm not saying that, you know, voters might necessarily put it along those lines, but I would also say this, as I said earlier, I think that, you know, Trump is fighting a culture war. That's what he does every day, whether or not he knows it or not. That is the ultimate outcome. And I think the Democrats are going to have to counter that, not with their own culture war, because I don't know that beats Trump, but one that is a defining vision. But unfortunately for everyone involved in this, all of us, next year will be a referendum on Trump. And it's whether or not there are enough Republicans, frankly, like me, who just said, I'm not part of that anymore, and are willing to, you know, actually show up and take something that they might not otherwise agree with in order to move Trump out of the White House.
Reid, have you been surprised by how Republican office holders have shied away from criticism of Trump and have been willing to align themselves with him, the very same people who 4 years ago were so critical of him as a candidate?
You know, I was at first, and then I remember that they're politicians. And, you know, the Trump carries around a very big stick and a very big bullhorn. And, you know, I think that, you know, one interesting thing in Bob's survey is that, you know, you see the 40% number of people who want the party to be more populist or as populist. You know, I think the important part of that number is that those are also likely the people who most often show up to vote, and especially show up to vote in a primary. And so what you see is that if some of these office holders, especially in the more red districts, get too far afield from Trump, then what they do is they find someone on their right all of a sudden who is willing to carry Trump's water, who is willing to do the things that he says. And you know, you find yourself out of a job. And these people, you know, the first thing they want to do is get elected. The second thing they want to do is get reelected.
JP writes on the page, I'm sure I'm not the only ex-Republican who'd like someone to make the party great again. Trump has turned it into a personality cult and reflects little awareness of traditional conservative values. Historians and this program will have years to figure out how it happened. Where is real leadership in that party? That's JP writing on the Air Talk page. Reid Galen, thank you so much. Good to talk with you again. Independent political strategist. And Robert Schrum directs the USC Dornsife Center for the Political Future and conducted the SC Dornsife LA Times poll. Bob, good to have you with us again.
Great. Thank you. And thanks, Reid.
Dare Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Coming up, the economic state of America. We'll hear competing thoughts about where we're headed. Back in 1 minute. Coming up just a few minutes here on Air Talk, we're going to hear from you if you went to a particularly notable Rolling Stones concert, a chance for you to share your memories, what made it such a great experience. This is the Stones. Prepare to play the Rose Bowl tonight, even at their advanced age. Maybe not for rock musicians anymore. There's so many of the heritage acts that are still out on the road. But the Stones, of course, they can fill stadiums and continue to do so. So you have a chance to share your favorite Stones concert. That's coming up later this hour here on KPCC. But right now, we talk about the state of the U.S. economy and whether we're heading towards a recession. The National Association for Business Economics earlier this week surveyed business economists, and about three-quarters of them say that they're concerned that President Trump's economic policies could send the U.S. into a recession by the end of 2021. Joining us, President of Path Financial LLC, based in Florida, contributor to Forbes magazine, Raul Elizalde. Thank you very much, sir, for being with us. Where do you think we're headed?
I think that if we are going for a recession, it will happen before 2021. I think that's way too far out. And if that is the case, I think that there is time between now and then to take care of that. But I think that all the indicators that I see are suggesting that the recession is much closer than 2021. I think that we could start seeing some significant deceleration in the next couple of quarters.
What are the factors you see that you think are precursors to recession?
Well, one of them, first of all, let me say that strong economic indicators don't necessarily weaken in advance of a recession, right? I mean, right before the last couple of recessions, retail sales was at an all-time high. Industrial production was at an all-time high. Unemployment was very low, just like today. So when you look at economic indicators, you don't really see that. What you start seeing some, the big headline indicators, but you start seeing some things that the market is telling you. The massive curve flattening, I think, is a big flashing orange light that is telling you that something is happening. Not just the inversion between the 2s and 10 U.S. Treasury bonds, but just forward rates, the fact that rates are negative in much of the developed world. All those things are very concerning to me. The consumer is not strong, as people seem to believe. I mean, that's a mantra that has been repeated over and over and over, how strong the consumer is, but that I don't see that as being the case. When people look at personal consumption expenditures, which is what people look at when they say, oh, the consumer is just, you know, on fire. Well, let's remember what that is. Personal consumption expenditures is goods plus services. Goods is the stuff that you buy when you feel flush. Services are what you have to pay because you have to. Healthcare, the rent, financial services, education. And those things have the price of that has gone up a lot, and it's far more important in the component of consumer spending that the stuff that you buy because you feel flush. So I don't see that the consumer is particularly in good shape. Mm-hmm.
Hold that thought. We'll come back. Raul Elizalde joining us. He's president of Path Financial LLC, investment financial advisor. Also with us, founding partner of Beacon Economics, director of the UC Riverside Center for Economic Forecasting and Development, Chris Thornburg. Chris, good to have you with us.
Nice to be back, Larry.
So, Chris, you think a lot of this is overblown talk?
Absolutely. And I would say that while I appreciate the comments of Raul, I would say that much of what he said I would functionally disagree with. Just take a broad step back. Recessions are anomalies. They are odd periods of time, and they don't just happen. There has to be a reason. There has to be a cause. If you go back to 2008 and 2009, when we had the Great Recession, the cause of that Great Recession had to do in the preceding years where there was massive imbalances. People were spending too much. We were building way too much housing. There was explosion of consumer credit, diminishment of the quality of consumer credit. Didn't matter how good the indicators were at the top. Obviously, there was an enormous amount of rot in the foundation. It was only a function of time before things collapsed in. There are no imbalances like that in the U.S. economy. And without a major imbalance to create a shock that could create a recession, I don't know how you could predict a recession. I don't really care what the financial markets say. The U.S. economy is not in that position right now.
And I guess there's always the potential for unseen or little credited factors like the collapse of the housing market, you know, ultimately being a driver. So that could always happen, right? But you said you're just not seeing the indicators now.
Right. Look, there could always be some mystery shock to the system. Perhaps it's something we haven't seen before. We don't have a good metric on. Perhaps I'm just not seeing it. I've never, no one's a perfect forecaster. But at least from my looking at things, all the indicators that I consider continue to flash green. Take the consumer, because I think it's important to talk about the American consumer. Consumer spending is close to 70% of GDP. If the consumer is healthy, they can push us through a lot of external turmoil, including this trade war. When people say the consumer is healthy, we're not talking about trends in spending. That's an effect, not a cause. When I say the consumer is healthy, what I'm talking about is, A, they haven't picked up a lot of debt. In fact, over the last 8 years, you've seen a diminishment in debt-to-income ratios because credit hasn't been expanding that fast. Savings rates are very good. They're at 8%, which is the highest it's been in 20 years, a very good sign for the economy because people have space. And, of course, because of the very tight labor markets, wages are rising really at a record pace right now relative to the last decade. So you have three major indicators that all suggest that the consumer is spending within line, they continue to see better economic circumstances, and almost assuredly that means continued growth in consumer spending, which will largely offset, I think, any kind of external turmoil between the United States and China because of these reciprocal tariffs.
Raul Elizalde, your response to that?
There are some good points, in particular the first one, that recessions are caused by things that probably you haven't seen. With the consumer spending, I do not see the strength. I see that consumer spending is going up strongly, but not because, but for the wrong reasons. It's because of all those inelastic elements that make up the consumer spending, as I mentioned, education, prescription drugs, bank fees. When you look at the price indices for those components, they have gone through the roof. There is just no option for the consumer to say no. And then when you look at the total dollars, it is a seemingly a strong proportion. It is a strong proportion of GDP, but for the wrong reasons.
But what Chris was saying, if I understood him correctly, is despite that, savings are up, people taking on debt is going down. So even with those increases on spending that has to be made, people are coping with that.
Look, the debt is a very important issue. And that was the trigger for the last recession. Not so much, I think, the headline numbers of the of debt, but all the contingent liabilities that nobody knew existed. When the real estate market took a turn, all of a sudden, all these debt instruments that were nobody knew existed in the form of collateralized debt obligations, credit swaps, all these strange things that were not tabulated anywhere came out to light and brought the financial system to the brink of a cliff. I see something similar happening today. The government debt is worrisome, but that's not it. The problem is private debt. When you have it's probably true that the consumer is not in bad shape. Who is in really bad shape is the corporate sector. The problem is that the banking system has been disintermediated. In 2007, businesses borrowed just as much from banks than by issuing bonds in the capital markets. Right now, businesses are funding themselves twice as much in the capital markets as from banks. Most of that debt has increased in the triple B credit rating category, which means that it's right on the edge of the junk bond netherworld. And if there is any problem rolling out that huge amount of debt that has been created, I think that we'll see credit spread increases, string of bankruptcies, okay, that can quickly snowball.
Chris Thornburg, quick final word on that.
Yeah, absolutely. So first of all, you could see it. It isn't true you couldn't see it in the data. There was an explosion of credit at multiple levels within the system, and it was obvious for anybody who was willing to look in 2006 that we had a big problem. None of those indicators are in place now. And while I agree that there has been a diminishment in the quality of debt, largely because of the displacement of banks, I completely agree with that statement. Here's a more important statement, a fact. Overall debt levels haven't grown. And ultimately, this debt cannot by itself create a recession. It has to create imbalances in the real economy, and those will create the recession. If there are no imbalances in the real economy, there won't be a recession. Now, again, that debt problem that's been described is real, but we're not going to see it until a real problem arises, and that could be 4, 5, 6 years from now.
Beacon Economics founding partner Chris Thornburg. Chris, always good to talk with you. Thanks so much.
Pleasure.
And our thanks to financial advisor Raul Elizalde, based in Florida, president of Path Financial, joining us on Air Talk. Coming up, we look forward to the Stones tonight at the Rose Bowl. They bring their tour to Southern California. But I want to hear from you right now, your favorite memory of the Stones in concert. Could be here in Southern California. It could be around the world. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Back after this live update from Michelle Faust-Raghavan. From their historic 2016 Havana concert, the Rolling Stones, Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, Charlie Watts, and Ronnie Wood, they continue their career 57 years after founding the Stones. Tonight, they're at the Rose Bowl, a sold-out concert as their tour continues across the country and around the world. I want to hear from you, your favorite Stones concert, as we prepare for tonight's event, which is a true Southern California cultural experience to see the living legends perform. What is your favorite concert performance that you attended by the Stones? Here or elsewhere, 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. One of those who attended that historic Havana concert was my son Desmond Mantle, who joins us today. Des, good to have you with us. You were on a student tour. Your school was in Cuba for a week and a half. How did you happen to go to the concert?
Well, it was actually, it was totally spontaneous. We didn't hear that the concert was even happening until shortly before we even arrived in Havana, because the trip had been planned long before. It had even been planned before Obama's historic visit to Havana, which happened in that week preceding. So to arrive there in this bustling time was actually not something that had been planned at the inception of the trip, but it's just really interesting that that happened. So we showed up in Havana. And we had a guide, a Cuban guide, as well as a driver. And the guide said that there wasn't any way that we were going to be able to get to the concert, that it was going to be too hard to get inside, and that there wasn't really any realistic way to transport 21 kids and three teachers into this concert.
A crowd of, what, 300,000 people? It was a free concert.
Yeah, exactly. It was a free concert. And so it was a huge crowd and everything. So anyway, we were all sort of disappointed, but okay, that's fine. Well, anyway, later on in the night, one of the teachers, the youngest of them, decided, you know what, I'm going to take these kids to see the Rolling Stones. So she packed 15 of us into a van that was built to hold maybe 8 people. And so we all packed into this van and drove through these back streets in Havana that this driver knew about that apparently no tourists take, and got us to the concert. And so we all got out of this overcrowded van, went inside. Security was, you know, two guys looking through our bags with flashlights and hoping that there was nothing dangerous inside. And then we go inside the concert and we all had to hold hands. We had to link arms.
So you wouldn't get lost
exactly.
In the crowd.
Yeah.
Now,
you know, being of what, two generations younger than the Stones,
yeah,
at least, what did you, your friends think about this? Were they looking forward to it? Did they have much familiarity with the Stones music?
I actually, it's interesting. I tend to tease my classmates about their lack of knowledge of older music compared to how much I appreciate music from the 60s and 70s. But what's funny is that with the Stones in particular, they actually did tend to have some more knowledge of the group, arguably more than I did in a number of cases. And so that was... it's definitely interesting that, you know, there were some fans really of the Rolling Stones among my friends, and even those who weren't fans understood the cultural impact the same way they would for the Beatles or the Beach Boys, other, you know, bands of that era.
And would you say this ended up being a highlight of your trip?
It was a highlight of the trip. Yeah, I mean, there was a lot of really great stuff that happened on the Cuba trip, but seeing the Rolling Stones at a historic concert in Havana, that was pretty amazing.
What was the crowd reaction among Cubans?
They were really happy to see this kind of thing. I mean, there were even, I even saw some American flags there, which was interesting. I believe shortly before our visit was when they unbanned American flags.
Because of Obama's appearance.
Exactly, yeah. And so there was an allowance of having people wear American flags or show support for America that's had previously been very much taboo in Cuba. And so seeing that at the concert was really interesting. People being very friendly to us as Americans, very warm with us. You know, there wasn't that kind of any kind of hostility. It was very they were happy to see greater interaction with Europe and with America.
Des, thanks for coming in and getting this kicked off. Appreciate it very much.
Thank you.
Desmond Mantle, my son, at that historic Stones concert in Havana. So let's hear from your personal experience. What was a real highlight for you? Nick in the city of Orange said, I was at the Hollywood Bowl in 1966. I was 15 years old. About the age you were, Desmond, the Stones. It was absolutely amazing. What made it even better was the opening band was Buffalo Springfield. Wow. That was a memory night, Nick. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Julie in Santa Monica, you were at the Tammy Show in Santa Monica?
Yes, Larry, in 1964. I was 11. And the Stone, it had every major band of the time except the Beatles. So every Motown band, every English band. And the Stones came out after James Brown, which was so unfortunate because Mick Jagger can't really dance. And James Brown was so fantastic. But the Stones were great. And the show is great. And if people don't know about it, they really need to look it up. It was absolutely unbelievable.
And now the video from that Santa Monica Civic Auditorium marathon concert, the video is out. For years, you couldn't see it. Those performances, they're now available. And that James Brown performance is incredible.
It's unbelievable. And my mother was there. She must have been in her 30s. And she fell in love with James Brown and the Stones. I mean, everybody. It was just an unbelievable show.
And so you were what, about 11 years old then?
11.
All right. Hey, Julie, thanks for sharing the memory. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Edith in Lake Balboa in the San Fernando Valley, take us back to your Stones concert experience.
Hi, good morning. It was another really historic performance. Was in the fall of 1964. I was a freshman at the University of Pennsylvania, and I think it was the Stones' very first tour. They had just released Aftermath with Mother's Little Helper and King Bee, the very first songs that they recorded. And they were not the main event. They were the opening act for, and here's the punchline, Herman's Hermits.
They opened. That's funny.
They opened for Herman's Hermits.
And no diss on Herman's Hermits. I mean, a very popular group. But, of course, the Stones go on to make history. Edith, so what did you think of the Stones in 64?
I thought they were great. I thought they were even better the following summer when they released Satisfaction and skyrocketed into fame.
Edith, thanks so much for your memory. Our phone line's open for you to share your favorite memory of seeing the Rolling Stones in concert tonight. Sold out performance at the Rose Bowl. I think it's been almost two decades since the Stones have played the Rose Bowl. And was about a year ago they played in Silver Lake, Little Club, a surprise performance. presence. So the Stones have played in all kinds of venues, all kinds of circumstances, but it doesn't get much more massive of a venue than the Rose Bowl in Pasadena, where they'll be tonight. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC, 866-893-5722. Mick Jagger and the Stones, 1978, Fort Worth, Texas, on their Some Girls album tour, Jumpin' Jack Flash. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3, back in just 1 minute. To Babylon tour of 1998, Bremen, Germany, the Rolling Stones. We're listening to some of their music, live performances, and I want to hear from you your favorite Stones performance, most memorable, and the reasons why. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. One of the most famous of Stones concerts was 1980 at the LA Coliseum. Yvonne and Tustin writes about that on the Air Talk page. I remember seeing them with my boyfriend for my 18th birthday. 1980, LA Coliseum. The Stones were preceded by three opening acts. Prince, who had to dodge beer bottles from rude guys who didn't like what he was wearing, or really not wearing, but man, he played a mean guitar, George Thorogood, and the Jay Giles Band. We got there the night before, spent the night in the parking lot, then went in when they opened the gates in the morning. We started off down on the grass, but by the time Jay Giles came on stage, it was so crowded. If you started to fall, you'd never touch the ground because the crowd would set you right back up. We moved to the seats, but they were already taken by then, so we ended up watching the Stones while sitting on the steps up in the seated area. Boy, what a concert. I'll never forget it. That's Yvonne in Tustin. Now, Nick Roman, our All Things Considered host, was also at that historic Coliseum concert when Prince was booed off the stage as one of the opening acts. And Nick apparently was one of the booers at the time. He didn't get it. He went on, of course, to be a fan of Prince. He got it later. But like so many others who were there to see the Stones, not understanding what in the world Prince was all about. Trevor in West Adams says, I was at their High Park show in 1968, also at the Anaheim Stadium show in 77. Something pretty funny happened at that show. Someone threw a shoe at Mick Jagger. So he stopped the show and said something like, if someone's going to throw a shoe, I want everyone's shoes. Pretty soon there was a massive pile of shoes on the stage. I think Mick said once the show was over, people could pick up their shoes in the parking lot. That's Trevor in West Adams. Now that's a star. You get have a shoe thrown at you, you stop the show and quickly come up with something like, I want everybody's, and you turn it into something quirky and humorous and make it for a concert unlike any other on the tour. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. I'd love to hear your memory, your favorite Stones concert, wherever that happened to be. Desmond Mantle, my son, joining us. You talked a little bit earlier about how your friends were pretty knowledgeable about the Rolling Stones. You think it's largely the cultural significance, or do you think that it's kind of the rawness of their music that's still the appeal for younger listeners?
I think it's both. I think cultural significance is a must for them to have even heard of it, you know, as churches. It's just sort of in order for it to be historically significant, they had to be culturally significant. So there's that aspect of things. But there are also a number of historically significant cultural things that most people my age have just never heard of.
Or aren't interested.
Or just aren't interested. Exactly. And so I think also the music itself has a huge appeal. Part of it is the fact that it's rock. And so unlike disco or unlike a number of parts of soul music.
Or blues. Yeah.
Unlike some of those styles where a lot of people in my generation just aren't into those styles of music, rock has continued. It's changed a lot, but it's still rock. And so to go back to that classic rock stuff with some of the Beatles stuff, with a lot of what the Beach Boys did, with all these other bands of that era, it's really something that's a lot more accessible to them because at least there's a recognizable style to it.
Also, the music is so frequently heard in films and I was going to say TV programs, probably a little expensive for TV, but you hear the music continuing as a part of other forms of popular culture.
Right. Yeah, no, I think that's definitely true. And I think also their parents listened to it, which is a big part of that. You know, their parents, their grandparents were listening to this kind of music. I, on the other hand, had you listening to James Brown, Donna Summer, artists like that that they might not be as familiar with just because their parents were a little different.
Old blues artists.
Yeah, exactly.
Obscure performances
right.
that I'm into.
Right.
Mary at Huntington Beach says, about 30 years ago, they played at Georgia Tech. My boyfriend wanted to see them. We bought a couple of seats way up high, but everyone stood up. I couldn't see anything. It was a terrible experience, though the music sounded great. All right. That's Mary. All right. And let's see. Lori says, tonight's concert will be bittersweet for our family. My brother Bobby was an avid Stones fan, saw them 33 times in his lifetime, starting at age 17 up to age 58. He passed away April 8th. Bobby had tickets to see him in May. It would have been his last hurrah as he had terminal cancer. Sadly, when Mick had to cancel the show, Bobby pretty much threw in the towel and died just a few weeks later. Tonight will be hard for all of us who love Bobby and love the Rolling Stones, but we'll be celebrating and remembering fondly all the great shows we saw with Bob. I'm sure he'll be rocking in heaven as well. Lori, what a beautiful musical eulogy for Bobby, for your brother, who passed away just a few months ago. Our sympathies to you and your family, and hopefully there'll be more sweet than bitter with tonight's performance at the Rose Bowl. Let's see, real briefly, Colin in Northridge, real quickly, your Stones memory.
Hi. I saw the Rolling Stones when they played at the Echoplex in Echo Park back in 2013, that tiny little venue.
Yeah.
It was one of the best shows I've ever seen.
And how did you find out about it? Because this was not widely publicized.
It was announced the day of, and I was actually at work that day and sitting, hearing about it on Twitter and on the radio. And after work, I immediately went down to the place where they were, where there was a lottery to get tickets, and I was one of the chosen people.
Wow. And could you, when you were sitting there listening to it in a venue of that size, you feel like, I can't believe this?
It felt like being in the greatest place to be in on Earth that day. It was, I think, their 50th anniversary tour, and it was the opening night of that. They announced the day of a specialty concert, so it was really unlike anything else.
Colin, what a great experience. Colin in Northridge, thanks so much. We leave you with 2016 Havana Moon concert in Cuba. Paint It Black, the Rolling Stones. We'll be back with a second hour of Air Talk here on 89.3. Good morning, it's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Wonderful to have you with us. Later this hour, one of my very favorite reporters, ESPN's Ramona Shelburne, will be with me to talk about her terrific five-part series on Donald Sterling and the LA Clippers. You know, it's just a few years ago, but I think I sort of blocked it out and put it in the back of my mind as though it was decades ago. It hasn't been that long. Steve Ballmer's been the owner of the Clippers. But Ramona Shelburne gives us a tremendous backstory to the whole Sterling affairs, as well as an update on where things have gone in the past 5 years. She'll be with us coming up later this hour right here on KPCC. But first, we take a look at some of the new challenges for those who are sperm donors, as well as the offspring of sperm donation, who hope to connect with those who donated the sperm that conceived them. Of course, there's another major third party involved in all of this. Those are the couples that use the donated sperm to achieve conception. I'd like to hear from you some of the challenges that you've had. If you're a sperm donor, for example, who thought you wouldn't be contacted by any offspring but have had that happen, a child who has come as a result of your donated sperm and you know, grown up contacted you, I'd like to hear how that experience has been. If you are the offspring of sperm donation, have you attempted to track down, to contact the man who donated sperm? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. With me, Associate Professor of Psychiatry and Director of UC Irvine's Medical Ethics Program, Dr. Aaron Cariotti. Dr. Cariotti, good to have you with us again.
Thanks, Larry. It's good to be back. Always good to be with you.
I appreciate it. So what's changed in recent years? I mean, I know in the past that the donors were promised that, you know, they would have their identities masked, they wouldn't be contacted. Has that changed?
Yeah, I think what's changed are mostly unforeseen developments in technology that has made donor anonymity more and more difficult these days, and probably within a few years may make it entirely impossible. So what's happened with this is that in the early days of anonymous sperm donation, donors were promised that their children would not be given information by the clinic about them because most of these individuals did not want their offspring reaching out and trying to form a parent-child relationship with them in the future. And many of them were only willing to donate under those circumstances. As those children grew up and reached adolescence, we saw sort of the first wave of this in the late 90s, early 2000s. Many of them started banding together and finding that they had a longing to know their genetic lineage. DonorSiblingRegistry.com is one example among several of ways that the internet made it possible for people to connect with one another. And that was a group of people that demanded a right to information about their biological origins and destinies. That's the language from their websites. There were several countries, Larry, in Western Europe that agreed that anonymous sperm donation was not good for the children who were conceived in this way, and that they did have the right to some information about their family medical history, for example, whether they were at risk for any genetic diseases. And so some countries banned anonymous sperm donation, but the United States did not. The United States maintained the practice of allowing this. But now what's happened is that with the widespread use by the public of genetic tests like 23andMe and other Ancestry.com, these sorts of things, once enough of these things are uploaded online, it's becoming easier and easier for children of what we thought were anonymous sperm donors to track down their biological fathers. So what's happened is not so much a regulatory change in at least in the United States, but rather an advancement in technology and the way in which ordinary people utilize genetic technology that has come, I guess, as a bit of a surprise to those individuals who thought they were donating gametes anonymously and now are finding that that their biological children are able to track them down. So this is creating, obviously, a lot of really complex family issues and identity issues for both the donors and the donor-conceived children.
We're talking with Dr. Aaron Cariotti, joining us from UC Irvine, where he's associate professor and directs the Medical Ethics Program. Again, I'd like to hear from you. If you're one of the three principal parties involved in the identification that might come years later of a sperm donor, that would be if you're someone who has donated sperm, if you were conceived as a result of sperm donation, or if you were a part of a couple who had a child or children conceived through sperm donation, your thoughts about how these reunions or contacts have affected your life. 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Also with me is Amira Hazenbush, who's a family formation lawyer. She provides legal assistance to families using assisted reproduction, including sperm and egg donor agreements. Ms. Hazenbush, thank you very much for being with us. It sounds like the law hasn't really changed around this. It's the technology, the genetic work that's changed everything.
Yes, it really is something that unfortunately, and this we see in all different areas, the technology is moving much faster than the law. And so people are finding through these genetic tests that they have, they might not have even known that they were donor conceived when they're taking the genetic tests, and they're finding this out. And there is no legal right to that information at this point in time, at least not in the state of California. And so I've received calls from people who, you know, are middle-aged people who have just found out that they have. One person said she had a father who she just found out is 99 years old, and you know, she wanted to know what her rights were to contact him and to get in touch, and had found a sibling, and the sibling wouldn't give access to the information. There is no legal right to that information, and so there's not much that people can do right now except try to hope that people will act in a humane way with each other and respect each other's privacy if that's what they want, or be open if that's what they want. And it is very different for every person. It's hard to develop a law that's actually going to satisfy everyone.
Well, and I wonder, I mean, is it possible that there would be enough individuals advocating for this that there might be a law that would demand openness out of this? Because you can think of the reasons why people would want that. If you're conceived with donor sperm, there's the issue of, you know, genetic health issues that you might want awareness of. The other is, and the odds, you know, might be long that this would happen, but there is the potential for relationships that are incestuous accidentally as a result of people not knowing that they were, you know, conceived from the same donor sperm or someone related to a donor.
Right. And that is a concern that people have. There are laws that are sort of, there are bills in the works right now in looking at least collecting more donor medical information and requiring that minimal amount so that people have access to that information. Nothing has been passed as of yet. But I think that the argument on the other side is, well, people will stop donating if people have to give up anonymity.
Yeah.
And what we're finding is that for a lot of people, that's not the case. A lot of people actually like the idea of being able to know what happened after they donated, because they sort of make this donation and walk away and have no idea if a person became a person as a result of it.
Well, let's bring a caller, Zach in Pasadena, into our conversation, who is a sperm donor. Zach, are you providing your sperm under a condition of anonymity, or are you just assuming that any conceptions that occur when they grow up, they could be contacting you?
Right. Yeah, I don't think at this point you can assume anonymity no matter what. It seems like technologically speaking, that's just an impossibility now. And in the process of vetting, the sperm bank kind of is making that clear now. There's no way to absolutely guarantee anonymity.
And as part of the vetting that they do, do they do full genetic testing of you to determine if there might be something that you could, you know, be passing on to offspring that would be some sort of a genetic predisposition or illness? Or do they do that kind of testing of you?
Definitely. Yeah, the testing is very rigorous. There's like four or five rounds, and it includes like blood tests, various DNA tests. Yeah, so it's you're well vetted, I would say.
And why do you do it?
So I'm one of the people who, you know, kind of think it's a cool idea to have offspring around that I don't have a parental relationship with. The combination of that, helping families, and, you know, that's kind of it. I think there's a certain biological drive to reproduce that drives some sperm donors, and it's not enough. It's not sufficient on its own, but at the same time, you know, it's part of the whole reason why.
It's so interesting, a drive to reproduce, even if you're not going to see the result of what your donation produced. That's fascinating. Zach, how remunerative is it in doing this?
How
much you pay to do it?
Oh, it typically pays, you know, low hundreds, like 100 to 200, I think, are most sperm banks.
And how frequently can you provide sperm to the bank?
1 to 3 times a week. And so that's where it gets interesting, because the sperm bank that I'm in has, they're trying to get people to donate more. So they have bonuses, which means they want everyone to basically max out the amount of times that they can donate. And you're supposed to, you know, abstain from any sexual activity 2 days before you donate.
So you're going without sex if you're keeping that schedule.
That's right. Yeah. So it's a lot easier if you're single.
All right, Zach. Hey, thank you so much for sharing your experience. I really appreciate it. 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Holly in Beverly Grove, please share your experience with this.
Hi, Larry. I am the daughter of an OB-GYN who practiced for a long time, and he died 20 years ago. And through 23andMe, my sister and I found out completely as a surprise that we had a half brother, and we have since found 9 others. So we are in contact with all of them. We're actually friends of all of them. My mom is extremely angry about it, but overall, it's been a really good experience.
Now, this through sperm donations that your father was making, and were these to patients getting fertility treatments?
Yes, and this was like in the late 70s, early 80s, and he also ran a program where he said he was using medical student sperm, and he did, but when the medical students weren't available, like in summer break or Christmas break, he stepped in and used his, so yeah.
And he didn't tell your mom, I'm assuming.
No, he did not.
Wow. So have her feelings about your father posthumously changed?
It has changed greatly. She has decided she no longer wants to be buried with him, and she's getting a new plot. So, yeah.
Holly, this is this is like a book in and of itself. How do you feel about your father doing this?
You know, I think he just did it to give these folks a child. And, you know, we've spoken with the moms, and, you know, they hold no grudges toward it. I mean, they got what they wanted. They had kids that were healthy and that they love. And, you know, my dad was a smart guy and he was a caring guy, and they all have smart, caring children. So, I mean, it was a win-win for everybody. I do kind of wish that maybe before he died, he'd told somebody or written something up for us to find at a later date, so we wouldn't have been surprised that way. But we've all kind of come to terms with it at this point. I mean, we haven't found all of them. I mean, that's the thing. Like on 23andMe, we're all just kind of waiting for another one to pop up. And it will probably be happening for the rest of my life.
Well, Holly, you said, I think, that he passed 20 years ago. He probably never envisioned the kind of genetic testing and widespread use as it is today, and that this would be discovered.
I don't think it really crossed his mind. I do know that, like, around the time he died, that they had cloned Dolly the sheep, so genetic testing was kind of moving in a forward direction, but he couldn't have predicted the internet and all of the information and data that would be, you know, available, that would be available to us. So, no, I don't think he remotely thought it would have happened this way at all.
All right. Hey, Holly, if you don't mind staying on the line, want to get your number. I wouldn't be surprised if producers are lining up for you to tell this incredible story. I'm going to put you on hold. That's Holly in Beverly Grove, 866-893-KPCC. Of course, your mother probably would not be happy with that, but 866-893-5722. That's an extraordinary story. I want to hear what our guests think about that. We'll also take more calls as we talk about sperm donation and the ability now of those conceived through sperm donation to be able, in many cases, to track down siblings, half siblings, I should say, sperm donors that allowed for them to be conceived. And of course, there are the couples who use donor sperm to have their children, who might have strong feelings one way or the other about their kids connecting with the donor of the sperm. 866-893-KPECC. We'll be back in 1 minute. Wow. I'm just gathering myself after the remarkable call from Holly. After genetic testing, discovering that her father, who had been an OBGYN and who died about 20 years ago, had used his sperm with fertility treatments of patients, and that she and her siblings had several half-siblings. We're taking your calls to talk about these reunions, these connections. Holly's case sounds like it's been very positive for her, very negative for her mother. 866-893-KPECC. UC Irvine professor Dr. Aaron Cariotti, who directs the medical ethics program at UCI, with us. Dr. Cariotti, your thoughts about Holly's story?
Well, it's certainly an extraordinary and staggering story, but it's turning out to not be all that unique. The New York Times just yesterday published a piece about this very phenomenon, these new revelations of fertility doctors in the early days of artificial insemination, late 70s, early 80s. Many of these doctors themselves fathering dozens of children. So there's more and more cases of these that are coming out now as genetic testing becomes more widely available.
Well, and it's
at least according to the Times story, not all of the outcomes for the siblings are as happy as the one that Holly described.
Yeah, and I wonder if it makes nervous, you know, the kids of fertility doctors, particularly back in that era, wondering, gosh, do I have a lot of half siblings out there?
Right. Sure. This theoretical issue of unintentional incest, there actually have been cases of this both in the United States and the UK. So it's not just, and it may seem statistically implausible, but if you think about if one donor, whether it's the fertility clinic doctor or another donor, is fathering dozens of children at around the same time and at the same clinic, so that many of those children grow up geographically in roughly the same area, so they're around the same age, and there's stories of half-siblings not knowing that they're related, you know, meeting one another in school or in some other activity and having this kind of immediate chemistry. Like, I always knew, you know, I felt like, yeah, I always knew this person, and we just understood one another, and they may start dating, they may consider getting married, and then do genetic testing only to find out later that, you know, perhaps one of the reasons they had this immediate chemistry is that
they're related. And then what do? You're in love with someone that you're blood related to. That's got to be a very, very difficult circumstance. Amira Hazenbush, a family formation lawyer, your thoughts about Holly's story?
Yeah, I agree. It's happening. We're finding out that it was happening more often than we thought. I think it will be of a certain era and won't be repeating now that we know that people can find out about it. But it's still an issue, not just in terms of is the doctor the donor, but are you receiving the donation that you thought you were going to be receiving?
Yeah, is there disclosure?
Right. Is there disclosure? Is there informed consent? And we're finding that now it might not be that you're receiving the donation from the doctor that you didn't expect, but there are many stories coming out of clinics accidentally switching the gametes that they thought they were going to be receiving. And so they may have thought that they were using the sperm of the spouse of the woman getting pregnant and ended up with someone else's sperm or a donor that they didn't select. And they're a lot of issues coming out around that.
I'll bet. Amanda in West LA says, I'm an egg donor. I donated to 6 families. Know for a fact that all produced offspring, and I've received some photos through the years. It's a really nice feeling. I didn't expect to feel the biological drive to reproduce, but felt a feeling of completion once I knew my genes were passed on. That's Amanda in West LA. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. John Paul in Beaverton, Oregon. I understand you were conceived through donor sperm. Have you tried to pursue your genetic father?
I have, actually. So I found out that I was donor conceived this Mother's Day, so fairly recently.
Yeah.
Through 23andMe, I was able to contact 6 half-siblings, and within hours, I had email addresses, the identity of the donor, and had established contact with 3 of my half-siblings. I have not written him yet, but I am in the process of doing that.
And what's been the response of the half-siblings you've contacted?
Oh, it's been amazing. So I grew up an only child. So
you thought.
So I thought, exactly. I'm the youngest of 7 donor-conceived offspring. So I've always had siblings. Actually, always had siblings in the rough geographic area I grew up. So I've always wanted a sister. And I actually met my sister in person last week. It was one of the most amazing experiences of my life, to say the least.
John Paul, it sounds like you're delighted that you did this, but a little bit concerned about contacting the donor of the sperm from which you were conceived.
I am. I might say more nervous than concerned. There is cause for concern. So many of the stories I've heard in donor-conceived Facebook groups and stuff like that didn't necessarily turn out very well. I do seem to be one of the lucky ones, if you can say that. My donor, I should mention, I also did Ancestry. And when I did Ancestry, the first match I got was my donor. So,
oh, okay.
Name is on there.
His didn't take long.
Information is on there. And I can click a button and contact him. That's incredibly rare, obviously. You know, you talked about anonymity before. So I'm not so nervous. It's more I'm just, like I said, I just found out Mother's Day, and I'm just kind of getting ready. I'm taking my time. I'd like to talk to my half-siblings more, the ones who have talked to him a little bit more. And, you know, I'm kind of just taking my time.
So some have contacted him. All right, that gives you a little preview at least. John Paul, thanks very much from Beaverton, Oregon, with us. Amber, listening in Brooklyn, New York. Amber, you contacted your biological father, and how did he respond to that?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. So I actually found out I was donor conceived when I was 29 through a 23andMe test as well. My parents never told me. They never thought I would find out. So when I did that 23andMe, I matched with 2 first cousins who were the nephews of my donor. And through the magic of some internet sleuthing, I was able to find his LinkedIn page. And my newfound half-sister and I sent a certified mail letter to his office because he was a doctor at the time. And it took him a while to respond. He was a little apprehensive, but the first time we spoke on the phone, we just connected right away. And shortly after that, the 3 of us met for the first time. And since then, you know, we see each other about once a year. And you know, we're friends. I've developed, I think, more of a sister-like relationship with my half-sister, but also since then we've found an additional, 5 siblings. His estimate is that there are 75 to 100 of us.
Oh my goodness. Wow. Talk about, a big family. You've heard of other, examples that haven't gone so well, though, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm definitely an anomaly in this case. You know, JP mentioned the Facebook support groups for donor-conceived adults like us. There's a lot of people who reach out to their biological families, and they are served with threats, with cease and desist. And it's really unfortunate because it's a deep sense of rejection. You know, obviously, donors, you know, they donate anonymously. The family signs a contract, you know, agreeing that the donation is anonymous, but these people, these human beings that are the result of this donation and this contract never consented to that agreement.
Yeah.
And so we're kind of in this legal limbo where I do believe all people have a right to their medical information, their ethnicity, their heritage, their genetic family.
Yeah.
And as donor conception exists currently, it's an intentional severing of that connection to your biological family.
Amber, I really appreciate your call. Thank you for sharing your experience and your perspective as well. Peter, in North Hollywood, I understand you donated sperm back in the 80s and 90s and that you've been contacted by the kids who came from your donations.
Yes. Hi, Larry. I donated back in the late 80s, early 90s, and then in October of 2017, one of the offspring contacted me. And in deciding that I would have a conversation with her, we did a video chat, and the connection was really clear. And so we ended up meeting the next day. Over the course of the next 3 weeks, she told me about 11 other half-siblings that she had already been in contact with or knew about. And then since that time, 15 more have shown up. 27 of them have been in contact with me. And then I've met 26 of them, and almost all of them are in a Facebook group. And three of the girls who didn't know each other before now live together.
You've got to be kidding. Peter, this is extraordinary. So you have at least 27 kids.
At least, yeah.
Astounding. How do you even have time to meet with all your children? 26 of them you've met with face to face. So how do you feel about all this?
If you'd asked me before it happened, if I would have ever wanted something like this to happen, I'd have said absolutely not. But having had it happen, it's really the best thing that ever happened to me. And with some of the kids, there's a very close relationship. And with some of them, we're just acquaintances. And it all is sort of based on what it is that they're looking for. I did a lot of reading when it first happened, and I sort of realized that if I'm going to allow contact, what I want to do is try to be a positive thing in their life in whatever way I can. And so based on what it is that they're looking for, I try to sort of open myself to that as much as I
can. And be flexible. That's fascinating. So, Peter, I don't know if you have a partner currently, if you've had kids with that partner. Has this caused an upset to the life that you had before?
I was married at the time that I found out. We were having difficulties, and we actually ended up getting divorced within the next few months after this happened, but this was not in any way the reason. I have a new girlfriend, and she's very open and sort of excited to meet all of the different kids. And in fact, she went to a reunion with me the weekend before last in San Francisco, where there were 12 of the offspring, and I met two of them for the first time.
And so, these are your only kids that you're aware of, these 27?
Stepdaughter with my ex-wife.
Oh, okay.
Who I was close with, but I was not her dad. She had a very involved father.
Peter, I appreciate your call. Wow. Remarkable personal experiences shared on Air Talk today. KD in Santa Monica says, I'm a single mom, had twins using an anonymous donor. They're 10 now. They talk to their friends about why they don't have a dad and explain they have a donor. It's a complicated, challenging issue to talk about. Dee in Anaheim said, I was a single mom, conceived my daughter through a sperm bank. My now 36-year-old daughter did a DNA test, but doesn't want to pursue more information about half-siblings because she doesn't want to see them as family. Cassandra in New Jersey says, I'm a donor-conceived person found about 2 years ago, met my father, some siblings through DNA testing. I'm in contact with him. It's a complicated experience, but it does help me understand who I am. You can share your comments on the AirTalk page, kpcc.org. And my thanks to our guest, Samira Hazenbush. Thank you so much for providing legal expertise. She's a family formation attorney. And Dr. Aaron Cariotti, UC Irvine, where he's professor and directs the medical ethics program. You're listening to AirTalk on 89.3. Ramona Shelburne coming up next of ESPN, a five-part 30 for 30 documentary series on former Clippers owner Donald Sterling, but it's about so much more. We'll talk with Ramona right after this live update from Michelle Faust-Raghavan. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. It was the noxious audio recording that rocked the NBA and launched a cascade of events permanently changing the culture of the LA Clippers. Team owner Donald Sterling verbally attacking his mistress V. Stiviano over her posting photos with African-American friends.
In your lousy Instagram, you don't have to have yourself with walking with black people.
And it bothers you.
Yeah, it bothers me a lot that you want to broadcast that you're associating with black people. Do you have to?
You associate with black people.
I'm not you and you're not me. You're supposed to be a delicate white or a delicate Latina girl.
I'm a mixed girl.
But that wasn't all that was on that tape. It included an attack on Magic Johnson, a beloved figure, not just in Los Angeles, but culturally a philanthropist, a man who's a business leader and an iconic figure. Beyond that, Donald Sterling, in an effort to repair his reputation, ended up going on Anderson Cooper's CNN show and doubled down on his Magic comments.
What has he done? Can you tell me? Big Magic Johnson, what has he done?
Well, yes, he's a business person.
He's got AIDS. Did he do any business? Did he help anybody in South L.A.?
Well, I think he has HIV. He doesn't actually have full-blown AIDS.
Well, what kind of a guy goes to every city, has sex with every girl, then he catches HIV? And is that someone we want to respect and tell our kids about? I think he should be ashamed of himself. I think he should go into the background. But what does he do for the black people? Doesn't do anything.
A jaw-dropping interview that only made things worse for Sterling. The tape of the V. Stiviano recording was dropped by TMZ Sports Friday evening, April 25th, 2014. Stiviano had claimed the recordings were made with Sterling's permission to remind him of things he'd said earlier and subsequently forgotten. Sterling's racist comments ultimately led to a forced sale of the Clippers to former Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer and a dramatic change in the team's fortunes. But there's much more to the story. At the back end, and in the 5 years since Donald and Shelley Sterling receded from the limelight, it's all part of a 30 for 30 five-part podcast series from ESPN's Ramona Shelburne. And who better to flesh out this story? Ramona, great to have you with us.
Thank you.
So you've been covering the NBA and LA basketball for a couple of decades now. You started doing this very, very young, and you were at the heart of the coverage of the whole Sterling debacle. Take us back to that, trying to stay on top of that story.
I mean, I felt like I was in a movie as it was happening, right? Like, you just had these moments in reporting the story where you would, like, call your editors. One of my main editors was a guy named Eric Neal at the time, and I would call him all the time, and I was like, you're never gonna believe this, man. Like, Shelley Sterling sold the team out from under Donald Sterling by getting him declared mentally incapacitated, like this little old lady with a Chanel bag who has this grandmotherly kind of presence and seems all sweet and nice. And you always kind of, she was just the wife. You didn't really think about her too much at all. You didn't really, she was just kind of like a collateral damage, you know, in all this. Not only does she sell the team, but she has to get him declared mentally incapacitated to do it.
And they've been married 50 some years by then, 60 years.
And she stood by as he's had affairs and done terrible things. And like all of this goes on. And then at the moment of truth, when they can stick together and sort of go down together, she says, I'm going to handle this myself. And I honestly, we might still be in court if she doesn't sell the team out from under him. And through all of this, I kept feeling like you could not write characters any deeper and weirder and more compelling than this. Like if you were a screenwriter, you couldn't write it any better. And so I think I always knew I wanted to do something more with this. And this was just a great vehicle to do so.
You have wonderful interviews here with people who worked with Sterling back at the time. Ralph Lawler, the great Clippers announcer, recently retired, speaks very poignantly, very openly about his strong emotions. Yeah. And that's a real gem.
So the interview with Ralph was one of my that was one of the ones that I was like, we have to have Ralph Lawler in this. He was the voice of the Clippers for longer than I've been alive. I mean, he's literally he predated Donald Sterling even. He was down in San Diego as the voice of the Clippers. And when you work for a team, you can't, even though you're the face and the voice of the team, you can't always say what you think. And you can't always reveal the way you're feeling about somebody and something. But Ralph, more than anybody in this story, saw Donald Sterling for who he was from the beginning to the end, from when he buys the Clippers when they were down in San Diego. And Ralph says, you know, they were just Donald and Shelly back then. They were just a nice couple that bought the team. And when we got up to Los Angeles, it was Mr. Sterling. You didn't have to, you weren't allowed to be casual with him anymore. You had to call him Mr. Sterling. And he tells me some stories about one of the assistant coaches who called him Donald in a meeting. And everybody goes, hey, Dave, you're not, you can't call him Donald. And the next year, that assistant coach was not back. So it was like
he became a different person.
Yeah.
And he had said he was going to keep the team in L.A. Mm-hmm. The league blocked him from moving. I'd forgotten all of this.
Yeah.
And then the case of the Raiders, of course, opened up the door for him to supersede what the league wanted him to do. And he moves the team to Los Angeles to compete with Jerry Buss's Lakers. And one of the things I was not aware of, Ramona, until your 30 for 30 podcast series, is that Jerry Buss probably doesn't buy the Lakers without the Donald Sterling's agreement to buy properties to fund the sale.
Yeah, it was a last-minute deal. So Jerry Buss has this deal to buy the Lakers from Jack Kent Cooke, who was going through a messy divorce and had to sell off some of his assets.
Speaking of other weird owners.
Yeah, right? And he's got everything lined up, and then at the last minute, some of his financing falls through, and he needs about $3.5 million to close the sale. And there's not that many people back in 1979 you can go to and say, do you have $3.5 million that I need in the morning, right? But Frank Mariani, who was Jerry Buss's business partner, knew Donald Sterling just socially because they were all just real estate guys in L.A. And they had a meeting at about 11 o'clock at night. The next morning, they went to the bank together. And instead of Donald Sterling buying into the Lakers, he said, I'll take your apartment buildings. So he gives him $3.5 million and gets 11 apartment buildings in Santa Monica. And that's how Jerry Buss closes the sale for the Lakers. That whole first year, the Lakers are the biggest show in town. I mean, this Forum Club becomes Studio 54. The Lakers win a championship. It's Magic Johnson. It's Showtime. And one of the frequent guests at the Forum Club and the special room inside the Forum Club, which was Jerry's room, invite only, was Donald Sterling. And at that point, he does what a lot of rich guys in L.A. who have a bunch of money and want some notoriety do. Says, hey, he goes to Jerry Buss's publicist and says, can you do for me what you did for Jerry? And his publicist, his name is Bob Steiner, says, no, it wasn't me. It was, you'd have to buy the Lakers. And Donald says, no, it was you. And 3 years later, Donald Sterling buys the San Diego Clippers with Jerry Buss as the guy vouching for him with the league.
Before you did the research for this, Ramona, did you know that Sterling had been so much around the Lakers and that he wanted essentially Jerry Buss's life? Because that was all new for me.
I had heard that story. It had sort of been lightly known. The guy who really brought that home for me was this a man named Jerome Stanley. He's in the podcast. He used to work for Jerry Buss. He was like a student at USC, and he like was a he would meet him at the press box and wait on him, and he worked the Forum Club. And he goes, yeah, Donald Sterling was always in that room. I go, really? Donald Sterling? I mean, I kind of knew about the financial deal, but I didn't know that he was always there, kind of on the outside of the Forum Club looking in saying, ooh, I think I'll have some of that.
Well, it's so funny because Buss had that kind of effortless seeming cool about him. Mm-hmm. So even as this older guy with the younger women and all, you kind of get the charisma of Buss, even apart from the Lakers.
Right.
Sterling never had that
and
sort
I think
of fun.
That's the big thing for me when I was reporting on this and feeling these characters, like Donald Sterling would have parties, but people were sort of forced to go to them. And Jerry Buss had parties, but people wanted to go to them. Nobody forced anybody to go to the Forum Club. They were dying to go. They were calling and trying to get on the list. At Donald Sterling's parties, they hired photographers and fake paparazzi to give it like this Hollywood feel. Jerry Buss's parties had that Hollywood feel because there were real Hollywood stars that wanted to be there. And I think it comes down to something very elemental, which is you can't buy respect. You have to earn it. And if you earn it by the way you treat people, by the way you go through life. And it's, I don't think Donald Sterling ever found that. And it's, you know, one of his employees told me at the end of this whole reign, look, if Donald doesn't own the Clippers, he's just another rich guy in L.A. The Clippers were the thing that made him somebody. It was the place where you would entertain clients. He was a very successful real estate guy. He's really smart.
Name on every building. It's in Beverly Hills.
Exactly. I mean, chances are if you've lived in an apartment building on the west side of Los Angeles, you've probably lived in a Donald Sterling apartment building.
He never sold anything.
Never sold anything. Not even his used cars. Right?
We'll continue our conversation with ESPN's Ramona Shelburne. The 5-part 30 for 30 podcast series just out this week. The Sterling Affairs. And if you're not just an NBA fan, but you're interested in L.A. lore, this is it. And we're going to get more into the despicable comments, what it revealed about a man who so many people close to him knew was a reprehensible figure, but what the effect was on the culture and the league. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Back in 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. So much to talk about, but after you listen to our conversation, better to listen to the 5-part podcast, 30 for 30, available through ESPN. I heard it on Spotify. It's available on a number of different podcasting platforms. ESPN NBA reporter Ramona Shelburne with us, Los Angeles native, by the way. So she grew up amidst the whole world of Lakers basketball and the Clippers trying to establish themselves here. The Sterling Affairs, her 5-part podcasting series. Speaking of Jerry Buss, as we were before the break, let's go back to this excerpt of the Sterling Diaries that deals with Jerry Buss.
Shelley Sterling remembers Jerry Buss came over to their house just hours after that middle-of-the-night phone call, and the two men went to the bank.
8 o'clock in the morning, he comes to the door, and I don't even think the bank was open.
Well, those are certainly not Donald Sterling hours.
No. Or my hours.
Then they went to Santa Monica so Donald could pick out 11 of Jerry's buildings to buy.
We bought a lot of the buildings from Jerry in exchange for the money that Don had lent them.
Basically, Donald was Jerry's banker.
This moment is not one that most Angelenos would expect.
The public impression of Jerry was he was a high liver. They thought he was rich as could be. And the way Donald operated, they figured this guy couldn't rub two nickels together.
It's extraordinary to me that you were able to get Shelley to take part in that and to provide so much background on this. What do you think motivated her to go on the record with this?
She's such a fascinating character. And I've gotten to know her really well over the last 5 years. And I think that she talks to me and we have a relationship because she knows that I actually saw her as more than Donald Sterling's wife. And I did it pretty early on. And as a reporter, I mean, this is, you know, you're covering something and there's a major character here who, like, most of the people are, you know, you just kind of chalk her up to, like, that's his wife. She stood by. She doesn't have any power here. But I went to this one game. I think it was game 5 of that playoff series where the tapes come out in the middle of the playoff series. People are talking about boycotting, and then Adam Silver bans Donald Sterling for life for this tape. And there's still the question of, okay, he's banned for life, but the Sterlings still own the team. So how are they going to sell it? How are you can say you can't come to the game, but he still writes the checks and collects the profits from whatever they do. And I go to the game, and there is an older couple with Team Shelly t-shirts on sitting in the press room. And I was like, Team Shelly? What's that all about? But like the reporter in me says, I better go talk to them and find out who they are. And it turned out they were Shelly's good friends. Her name is Catherine Bauman and her husband was Jim Henderson. And they told me the story of Shelly, like where she figures into all of this. And her contention was, this is community property. We own the Clippers together. We have been in business together for 60 years. Everything that Donald owns is at least, you know, just as much mine as his. And she's played a vital role in building their business and in running the Clippers for all these years. And he may be the forward-facing guy here, but she has rights too. And why should she pay for what her husband did? And I said, it's kind of interesting. And I, right about the same time, her lawyers were around. And I started talking to them, and then I called the NBA, and I said, "So what's all this with Shelly?" She says she wants to be involved in this, and they said, "Shelly doesn't matter at this point. They were just going to proceed with, you know, having a vote of voting him out of the league, and then selling the team themselves." And I said, "But what if she can sell the team?" And they said, "Well, that's nice. If she can sell the team, we'll be happy to have her help. But we can't sit back and wait on this. We have to just proceed along the way we're going to do it." Not only did she find a way to sell the team, she did it faster and for more money than any team had ever sold for.
$2 billion.
It was four times what the last team had
sold for. Yeah, Milwaukee.
Yeah,
it's just incredible. And solve the league's problem. Yeah. But the flip side of that is it enriched the Sterlings, and they sold for a fortune they never could have imagined previously.
Well,
was the value of the team?
Yeah, I mean, Donald in court says, "I think we could have got $9 billion," right? I mean, that's a negotiation tactic, okay? And maybe he's right. I don't know. I mean, he's pretty good at business and the way he's run his real estate business. But I think, you know, going back to your original question of why does Shelly talk? Why does Shelly open up the way she does? She'd never done an interview before any of this. She'd never been forward-facing at all. She's quite shy and reserved. But sometimes, maybe in the same way that Ralph Lawler talks, like when you're not able to say the things that you want to say for an entire lifetime, and then somebody comes to you and asks the right question and sees you in a light that no one's really presented you with before, you talk.
Mona, one of the things I had no idea was how close the Clippers and Warriors, they were playing in that first round series when this all broke, how close they were to not playing, and the kind of pressures that the players under. I mean, there were people who were attacking the players verbally if they didn't refuse to play, as though they were just kowtowing to a racist. So much pressure, and of course, Doc Rivers, the coach, became the forward face of the franchise, a remarkably poised performance by him and having to carry all that pressure on his team. This and much more, Donald Tokowitz, his boyhood in Boyle Heights, Roosevelt High School, all this stuff, the preamble to it, it's all in the 30 for 30 podcast series, The Sterling Affair. Thank you so much, Ramona Shelburne, for being with us.
You got it. Thanks for having me.
Have a great afternoon from all of us at Air Talk.